kind of annoying, but I did mention before that there was a certain home run ball the Suns could swing for, and it appears that they actually connected. Go figure. After a 25-win season, here we are, episode 22 of the Phoenix Suns podcast here on Bright Side of the Sun. Chris Habas, as always. Jim Kokenauer riding co-pilot with me and keeping me in line. So, Jim, the Suns make news yesterday, because this is going up here on Wednesday. The Suns make news yesterday hiring their new general manager. I called him a home run. I've met him once or twice. Seems like an extremely bright kid, and calling him a kid is not out of line for how old general managers are. How did you think about this hire?
I was actually initially a little bit disappointed when I heard the news that the Suns had passed me over in their GM search, but I can graciously accept defeat, and there's nothing wrong with finishing second. So congratulations to Ryan on his new job, and hopefully he will perform well in that capacity, and the Suns have a bright future ahead of them in the coming years.
Yeah, I definitely think so as well. And the kind of a funny thing is that you actually posted a resume online hoping that somebody would see it and bring you on. I wasn't pining for the job at all, but I had a few people on Twitter letting me know that, asking me if I got an interview for it. I thought they were being sarcastic. They might have been. I don't know. I'm going to pretend like they were being serious and thought that I was a legit candidate. But, you know, he's if Ryan's a kid, then I'm a toddler compared to him, because I got a few years under him right now. But the Phoenix Suns, usually you see teams try and pick off of this very, very fruitful San Antonio Spurs franchise, and they go after those guys and they try to, you know, hopefully emulate what they got by getting a guy that's been there. The Suns went a little bit different. They picked off of another franchise, the Boston Celtics, that had been really, really good for a really long time. They grabbed a guy with pedigree in Ryan McDonough. And the great thing with Ryan is he's only 33 years old. He gets a 4-year contract. But when you look at him and say he's only 33, he's been with the Celtics organization for 10 years, 4 as the assistant GM, 7 or more, because he was actually scouting before he got with the Celtics, 7-plus years as a on-the-road scout, regional scout, video coordinator. Those guys starting off in the video room are starting to make it big when you look at Portland's head coach, Miami's head coach, now the Suns general manager, the Houston Rockets general manager, Daryl Morey. Everybody seems to start in the video room nowadays. I think that's a very good trend, and it's a good thing that the Suns got one of those guys, because those teams have all had success themselves.
Yeah, it seems that from what I've heard, and I'm not going to sit here and claim that I have a lot of knowledge on this matter, because to be perfectly candid, I didn't even know who Ryan McDonough was 2 to 3 weeks ago, so I've been learning on the fly. And I think it's good that the Suns have stepped away from the Spurs tree, because that was almost like some kind of insidious relationship. Blanks was like an anathema. He was like a curse sent by the Spurs to destroy our franchise. So maybe getting talent, front office talent, from your bitterest rivals isn't actually the best solution in hindsight. Now, McDonough seems like he has a lot of the aspects that I would like in a GM candidate, that he's analytical, that he's a basketball junkie, that he likes getting his eyes on lots of players. I think that I had heard that he had about 1,000 players that he's actively scouting and has profiles and information and has watched video on. So he's basically an encyclopedia of basketball scouting. So he brings that to the table, like you said, the video and film side of it that he's deeply entrenched in. So I would say that I'm cautiously optimistic, but at the same time, part of it, I guess, is my lack of knowledge, my ignorance on the subject. And the second part of it is just that with any of these things, you can have an opinion, you can have an educated opinion going into it, but until the rubber hits the road, you don't know for sure whether a guy is actually going to succeed or fail. A lot of it is what he brings to the table, but some of it's luck, too, and I firmly believe that. So it's a hard job. There are 30 GMs in the NBA, and a lot of people want those positions. They're hard jobs. And, you know, we'll see if McDonald's up to the task.
Yeah, and you know what? Here's the thing, and I'll follow your lead on that one, is that who knew that R.C. Buford, a guy who played basketball before, but when you look at him, you don't think basketball player. You probably think, hey, that guy can probably fix my computer because he doesn't look like a basketball guy. Same thing with Ryan. He doesn't look like a basketball guy. The only thing that looks like basketball about those guys is that they're usually standing in a gym with a notepad or, I'm sorry, it's 2013, with like an iPad or a netbook or something like that, jotting down notes and keeping up with players. That's the only thing that screams basketball about these guys. Who would have known in 2002 when the San Antonio Spurs hired R.C. Buford as their GM after letting Greg Popovich had ran that for about 5 years, creating the dynasty that they were. But 2002, he takes over, and R.C. Buford has been manning the ship and keeping them afloat as one of the top, two or three teams probably in the NBA over the past 11 years. You'd never know. I mean, R.C. Buford turned out terrific, and it worked, but he already had Tim Duncan and Tony Parker, blah, blah, blah. But with Ryan McDonough, he could be that guy. You don't know. He could be, the next R.C. Buford, Sam Presti type of a guy that can build and create a franchise, has an eye for talent. But then again, we've all revisited the quotes. I mean, Lance Blanks was called a basketball genius, and, he was called great basketball talent and mind and this and that and the other thing. But, you're right. The rubber's got to hit the road. We got to see what he can do. But the good thing about him is that he's always in the gym. If you need to learn more about Ryan McDonough, this is what I would tell everybody to do. I'm kind of promoting SB Nation here a little bit as well as this writer, but Paul Flannery of SB Nation wrote out, and we'll link it here in the podcast. He wrote a long form article about Ryan McDonough and his path to where he was presently as the assistant general manager of the Boston Celtics, and broke down and kind of details for you everything that you just said about the scouting and all that. That's really all you need to read. And then obviously with tomorrow's press conference, then that's a little bit more where you can learn a little bit more about Ryan, hear his voice, and hear his vision.
With lots of GMs, the problem in terms of evaluating the success of a hire is that it takes a little bit of time for their vision to take form. Now, based off the press release and the announcement today that McDonough had been hired, there was a lot of positive things said, and I think a lot of it was genuine. But usually the process of when a hiring announcement of this magnitude is made, it's not typical that everybody comes out and starts, bemoaning the selection and, casting invectives on the newly appointed member of the organization. So just because he's getting all these flattering remarks and plaudits, I mean, that's normal. I mean, usually, and there's sometimes that there's hires that people just really don't understand or like, but generally people are going to say these kinds of flattering things about a new hire like that. With McDonough, though, with the way that this team is constructed right now, with the way they're rebuilding, I think we'll have a good idea on what kind of job he's going to do this summer. Because while his draft picks might not have developed yet, and it's going to take some time to see how that works out, the way they structure the team, the cap, free agency, this will give us an idea of what Ryan is trying to build here, what his goals and ambitions are. Because I think that if he kind of goes with the skeleton crew type of mentality and doesn't go after stopgap talent, then that shows you that he's looking at the bigger picture and he's willing to suffer now and go through some pain, the growing pains, in order to make the Suns more successful in the long term. And I think that's what he's going to do. And if he does that, I'll have a lot more confidence. So that's one thing I'm waiting to see.
Yeah, and the thing with any new hire, you can call him a rookie or a new guy being brought onto a job, you got to have patience, right? I mean, you got to allow him to actually get in there and put his imprint on the team and let him get out there and do what he needs to do. And a year is not going to show that. Maybe 2 years doesn't show that. Probably after about 3 years, when you've had a couple of draft picks, you've had a chance to expunge the roster and kind of purge it and go through it, then you're going to see really what this is going to be at the end of the day. And let's kind of do that real quick. Let's look at the roster and differentiate what's an asset, what needs to go, and, you know, what's something that they can kind of, you know, just keep and build off of. You mentioned stopgap talent. You do kind of have to have stopgap talent. You can't just go in there. If you have a roster of rookies, as much as that sounds just salivating to any fan of a team that's not playing well, you're going to play worse. I mean, granted, the Orlando Magic weren't that much worse than the Suns. They were 20 wins. The Suns were 25 wins. But they went out there and played a litany of rookies, one-year, two-year guys. They have a whole bunch of youth. They have all that young talent that you want. They won 20 games. They're going to get another one of those young talents that everybody wants. They're going to be bad for a little while. But the good thing about that strategy is that you then can let those young guys go out there and, you know, learn by fire and see what you got out of them. And it ended up working out for them. If you have a whole bunch of young guys and two or three of them rise to the top, then it was worth it to have a couple of down years, and that's what the Suns are having this year. They just don't have a lot of, you know, those talents where it makes it worth it. When you're looking at the Suns roster, and these are guys that are under contract for next year, let's kind of go through it. So let's real quick kind of go through each name. You tell me what you think they are. Are they an asset? Do we need to get rid of them? Is it like a stopgap guy? I think we both agree Goran Dragic is an asset to build off of. He's not a franchise cornerstone. I don't think he's a number one guy in a franchise. But I think now that you have him locked up long term, you probably have a guy who could be maybe the third or the fourth best player on a team competing and challenging for the playoffs.
Yeah, he's not untouchable, but I can't really see the Suns involved in some kind of deal in the near future where he would be a key component of a type of trade that would land us a star player. So Goran's obviously an asset, and I see him staying for at least next season.
Now you move into expiring contract. One of the team's best players over the past couple of years, Marcin Gortat. I'm just going to call him straight up an asset. I think he's a guy that the team just has to look at him based on his inherent value, not based on are they going to keep him. Because as much as we love the Polish quote machine that is Marcin Gortat, and he's amazing with the media, he's amazing with the fans, he clearly has a lot of talent and is one of the best centers in the league, but it's not consistent. It's a little bit different without Steve Nash. He's a guy that I think you look at as an asset, and unfortunately his value dropped this year with everything that happened, but he's a guy where you probably need to shop him around and get what you can get out of him.
Yeah, he's a little bit quizzical there. That's a little bit of a conundrum there, because he does go in the asset column, but like you said, his value has dropped, and really I only see him as an asset up until the trade deadline, at which point I don't think he has any value, because he'll be 30 years old, and I don't want the Suns to be the team that re-signs him and gives him a 3-4 year deal at the age of 30, especially on a rebuilding team. So temporary asset, and hopefully our new GM will be able to parlay him into an asset further than this next season.
I'm going to lump them in together because that's just what happens with twins. Markieff Morris, Marcus Morris. I honestly don't know if they're much better than the eighth and ninth best guys on a good quality playoff team that's making a challenge out there in their conference. Where do you see those guys? I really don't see them being better than eighth or ninth, which, I mean, they'd be really, really good eighth or ninth guys, but I don't really know if their potential goes higher than that unless they really work on their game.
Yeah, I actually just did a review on Markieff for the 2012-2013 season. I'm moving on to Marcus next. And Markieff showed absolutely no improvement from his rookie season to this year. And where he ranked out in terms of statistics metrics basically said that in his second year that he's not even one of the top 60 power forwards in the league. So at this point, he's not even capable of being a backup power forward. And since he hasn't improved at all, this next year is going to be big for him, because if he doesn't make a move and show some signs of improvement, then I think the Suns will have a very serious discussion to be held about whether they're even going to pick up his first team option year, unless he's moved or some other scenario plays out. And Marcus is basically in the same boat. These guys are both second-year players that have shown very little, an exiguous amount of improvement. And so I would put them basically as neither assets or liabilities at this point based off of their small cost-effective rookie contracts, but like you're saying, I mean, even on a crappy team like the Suns, they're like eighth and ninth players.
Yeah, yeah, very true. And then you switch gears over to, I'm going to lump them together for time purposes, but you have Channing Frye, who 9% or 90%, whatever he's tweeting about, hopefully it's 90. I know we had a little bit of fun with that confusion there with Channing saying his status, but you have Channing Frye, who's a fan favorite. You have Jared Dudley, a fan favorite. Both of them have contracts that lock them up at least to the 2014-15 season, and Jared goes a year past that with a player option. Those two guys, I think, are genuinely guys that can be your sixth and seventh guy for sure. I think those are guys that can come off the bench. They've done it in the past, immediately off the bench, play multiple positions, and have really good inherent value. Are those keepers or are those assets? Because I don't really think they fall into any other category.
Well, Channing is only an asset if his health improves and he can play next year. Obviously, the best players are the ones that can play.
Yeah, let's go with him being 100% healthy. Would you categorize him as an asset or as a keeper?
If he's 100% healthy, then he and Dudley are both big assets. Channing might even be the second or third best player on the team if he's back to his old form. And both of them are good character guys. With their work ethic, with the improvements they've made in their game, I think they're excellent guys to have our young players, our rookies around, the guys that McDonald's going to draft. So I think they're very useful in that role. Dudley is still young enough. He could be part of a rebuild. So I wouldn't look at moving him unless the right deal came along. I wouldn't be shopping him for sure. And same thing for Channing. I think that both of those guys are probably keepers unless, something very propitious, advantageous comes along.
Yeah, and you know what? And you saw the teams that wanted Jared Dudley when the rumors were going around, and you saw that, contenders were seeking after specific types of players to bring to their team and dump big contracts and stuff. Jared Dudley was a guy that the stat heads, the quote-unquote stat guys, they all wanted Jared Dudley. Teams like Memphis wanted Jared Dudley. They're a very, stat, quote-unquote, oriented team with John Hollinger running their business there. So, Jared Dudley, now he's got a stat-oriented guy as his general manager. As you mentioned, not an old player, a guy who consistently improves every year. The numbers may not show it because he didn't have Nash this year, but, he's a guy who improves a little bit every single year. He's a guy that gets better. He's young. He's not on a bad contract at all. I think he's a guy that if he can rise back up to the productivity and be as good of a player as he was with Steve Nash without him next year, then you're talking about a guy who probably has the best contract or arguably one of the top five contracts in the NBA based on what he brings to a team and how much they're paying him. Jermaine O'Neal's not under contract for next year, but I want to lump him into this column with Luis Scola as well. Scola is now able to be moved now that he's had a year here under the amnesty. So you have Luis Scola not making a lot of money, but, up there in age, a guy who probably wants to, get on a contending team for his twilight years or maybe move on and go back to Europe or retire. Those two guys, are they keepers as stopgap guys? Are those guys that you'd like to move away from? What do you think those guys are?
O'Neal might be fine to keep around as a veteran presence, with the caveat that if there is a promising young big, then I'd definitely go that direction instead. And Luis Scola, I would like to see moved. If he could return something like a late 2014 first from a contending team, something like that, then I pull the trigger on that deal in a heartbeat. If they can get a young player with some potential, maybe a power forward that actually might have a future in the league, unlike a couple of the ones they have on the roster, then that would be a move I would do right away too.
Smiling West did not get his contract picked up. He didn't get that option picked up to stay with Phoenix guaranteed next year. I think his option was in that $4 million range when you look at it based on the rookie scale. I don't know the exact number offhand, but I think it's in that $4 million range. Is he a guy that's going to command at least $4 million a year in the offseason and the Suns lost their guy? Or did they make the right call and they're going to be able to bring him back for less than $4 million, you think?
To tell you the truth, I don't really want him back either way. I don't really see a lot of value there. Looking at some of the advanced stats, I guess he did improve just slightly a little bit, but almost imperceptibly. And, like one common metric, the win shares, he's a zero. He's a flat line. So he basically does nothing. And I don't see that there's still a lot of room for development. I think he kind of is what he is. So I would rather the Suns just move on.
And guys that I think we both are 100% going to be on board with this, I think, if I know you at all from talking to you for at least 22 conversations that I'm going to admit to, Kendall Marshall and PJ Tucker, I'm going to put them both, I'm not going to call them assets because I don't think that either of them have dramatic value on the market, even though PJ Tucker is clearly better than, you know, a D-League international guy. He's an NBA player. I think both those guys are, you know, 9th, 10th guys, you know, maybe 8th, 9th guys on a quality playoff team. I think they both have their better years to come. I think PJ is going to get better and continue showing improvement. And I think Kendall's a guy who, I said it when he was drafted, if he gets on an up-tempo team, he might be able to start with a lot of talent around him, but he's a guy that's probably going to end up being a career backup. That's what I said on draft night. And I think he's a guy that can develop into a solid backup, even play with Goran sometimes. I think those both go under the keeper category for me because I don't necessarily think they're assets, but I wouldn't chase them out of town either.
Yeah, definitely you got to keep those guys. You can't really move them for anything, but Tucker is a great hustle energy guy. He's another one of those guys that can hopefully some of his work ethic can rub off on the younger players. And then Marshall, obviously, it's his second year, and you got to figure that there's basically no way the team's not going to keep him around for 3 years to see how he develops. You're not going to give up on a guy after 1 year.
Yeah, and so now we're going to slide into the final three, and there's a reason why they're the final three, because they're probably all going to go together, or rather final four, sorry. Hamed Haddadi and Deonte Garrett, both perennial DNP coaches decision type of players on any team that they're on probably, but basically like practice players and guys that know the system because they've, well, at least Deontay's been here for a little bit now. But are either of those guys, are you interested at all in bringing either of those guys back? Deontay's got a qualifying offer. Hamed Haddadi's got a team option. You can let both of them go and save about $2.1 million, or you can bring them both back as your, you know, 14th and 15th guy DNP coach's decision.
I couldn't care less. I don't think about those guys. If they're around, then that's probably fine. I kind of suspect that with the new GM coming in, that Ryan's going to want to pick some of his guys to be on the end of the bench. So I think it's very likely that they're gone. But either way, it's not going to hurt my feelings since they're not likely to see much, if any, court time.
Yeah, and you have three picks, too. You got to think that the number 30 guy is not going to set the world on fire. He's probably going to end up being like an end-of-the-bench guy, maybe replacing one of those two. The number four pick, if it ends up being number four, is going to get playing time. You got to have him on the roster. And the 47th pick, you never know. I mean, if you strike gold, then, or sorry, 57th pick, you know, if you strike gold, great. You know, he's on the team. But if you don't strike gold or you get a Euro stash away, but you got to at least have two roster spots open, those guys might be part of the roster spots. Now, here are two guys. I think the answer to the first guy that I'm going to tell you is stretch provision, goodbye. I think the answer to the second guy is you can cut him for half of his contract and you can let him go. I think you do that with both of them. I think they both need to go as soon as possible. It's probably got to be the first two decisions that Ryan makes, even before they get a coach, is just coming to that decision internally on Michael Beasley and Shannon Brown. Shannon Brown, out of, I don't know if you want to call it respect or just in general, I think they got to let him go. Just cut him. You know, he can go or you can trade him and that team can cut him for half the value. Me and you have gone back and forth on how that's actually a really good asset with today's, you know, current system with the cap and everything. And also with Michael Beasley, with the, you know, the everything in January this past year was awful for him, apparently. I think he's a guy that you got to cut your losses. You got to let him go.
Brown should definitely be let go. They can absorb the part of his contract, the partial guarantee, and let him try to seek gainful employment from another NBA franchise. Michael Beasley, whether they stretch, waive him, I actually prefer the waive. You might as well just get the pain out of the way now.
That's true.
The team isn't trying to compete, so I would prefer going with the waive. But that is not a guy that you want on your basketball team. My biggest reason that I want to waive him, even though I've heard some people say, well, just keep him on. He's the saboteur. He'll help you lose a lot of games and have a better draft pick next year. But I don't want him around the young players. I don't think he has a work ethic. I don't think that he has the mental fortitude to succeed in the NBA, and I don't want that rubbing off on the new players McDonald's going to bring in. And I don't think he's going to want that either. And so I just can't envision a scenario where Beasley is still on our roster on opening night next season.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And what's funny with Michael Beasley is I was just the other day flipping through channels, and don't ask me why, but I stopped on purpose on Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the movie made with Mos Def and Sam Rockwell and a bunch of nobodies. But I stopped on that movie for a second, and I kid you not, I'm watching that movie, and I literally saw Michael Beasley's correlation on a movie screen as good as I've ever seen it. And it was, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie or read the books, but the dreary robot that's in that movie that just walks around because he's given human emotions, and his human emotion is he's always just a bummer. And it just reminds me so much of Beasley, because when you look at Beasley, you go, oh, he's a big 6'10", 200 and whatever pound, strong, athletic, talented as all get-out looking basketball player. But just like you said, everything inside is just not right. And you look at a robot and you go, it's a robot that can do some kind of a function, but everything inside is not right. It's set to be just on bummer mode. And that's kind of with Michael Beasley and with any kind of a business, basketball, sales, whatever it is, it's the people on the ground floor that make the culture. And then it's everyone above them that, you know, sets the philosophy and kind of, you know, instills the culture and makes sure those guys do it. So with a guy like Michael Beasley, who's not a bad guy in all intents and purposes, obviously with the sexual assault thing, that's true, clearly a bad guy, but I'm just speaking from my experience with him as a basketball player talking to him. He's not a bad guy, but you're right. He's not motivated. He's kind of just a, you know, just down guy, quiet guy. And when he doesn't want to do something, he just doesn't do it. Maybe not maliciously, but he just doesn't do it. You can't have that around, you know, a top five pick that you're about to have, another first round pick that you're about to have, impressionable rookies, impressionable second year guys that you have on your roster now. I agree with you. Actually, I say bite the bullet and cut him now. I completely disagree with my own idea of the stretch provision. You're right. Get rid of him now. 2 years a year for, or $2 million a year for however many years it would be, like 6 years, I believe. It's a small bullet to bite. It lasts forever, but it's like a small bullet. I would rather just bite it all now, get rid of him. You're not competing. You're signing guys on rookie deals anyway. And just, you know, get rid of him, have him off the roster. There's just too much going around him. As much as I want to see him succeed and get back on his feet and make it, because that's what we do in this country. We, you know, people fall down and we want them to get back up. Hopefully he can do that in general. But it looks like if we're going off of what me and you just talked about, we have Goran Dragic, Jared Dudley, Jermaine O'Neal, Kendall Marshall, and P.J. Tucker on the roster next year that we all agree with. Marcin Gortat, Channing Frye, Luis Scola are assets, and the Morris twins are we don't know what to do with these guys. Everyone else gone, and basically Ryan, it's almost like a clean slate to build off of with some nice quality talents, you know, in Duds, in Goran, in Marshall, Jermaine O'Neal, Tucker. I think that you have a nice little base to build off of, but I don't think you have your best player. I don't think you have your second best player or your third best player. You got to go find those guys.
So we just laid out the blueprint for Ryan for his roster moves.
Yeah.
And then as we move forward with the podcast, we'll also advise him on to kill the draft. And then again, what moves he should make in free agency. So as long as Ryan tunes into the podcast, he should become one of our religious listeners, and he can have us break it down for him, and it'll make his job a lot easier.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, in all honesty, an extreme layman can look at this roster. If they watched any sample size of the Suns this year, I think a layman can look at this roster and go, at least most of the keepers, they would probably mark as keepers. Most of the assets, they'd probably mark as assets, and most of the goners, they'd mark as goners. I slightly disagree with you on Wes. I mean, if you can get him for like $2 million a year for 2 years with a player option or something like that, like sign him to a $6 million deal for 3 years with a player option as the last one, or sorry, a team option as the last one, I don't hate that, simply because if he's not working out, then just do what Gentry did. Just put him at the end of the bench. He's not Beasley. He's not going to complain. He's not going to fight it. He's not going to be a nuisance. He's just going to sit there and smile all day, and we're going to give him amazing Christmas presents every single year. So he's a guy that I don't dislike bringing him back for that value, but if he's, you know, demanding $4 or $5 million on the open market and he says, hey, guys, this is what I'm getting from someone else, match it, I don't think I match it, because I don't think the value matches up, as you mentioned, with advanced stats or stats in general. He blows up every now and then for 20, and he's pretty average, you know, on other nights, and on the nights he goes for 20, they don't necessarily win. So that's something that you got to keep in mind as well. If you're getting 20 and you're winning, that's a guy you want. If you're getting 20 and you're losing, that's extremely questionable and probably a guy you don't want. Moving forward, to step off of the Suns a little bit, let's go into the scope of the NBA. There's other teams in the playoffs. What are your thoughts so far on the NBA playoffs? We've gone through one round. not a lot of surprises outside of the Golden State Warriors, and at least in my opinion, and you know, some extremely entertaining second round matchups.
Yeah, the second round matchups are a lot better than the first round. What has actually stuck out to me, the dominating theme of the playoffs so far, is that they have been punctuated by a lot of injuries to key players, to marquee players. And I think to a certain extent that's really detracted from the entertainment value, that you want to see the best players playing, and that gives you the best chance to watch the most entertaining, exciting, competitive brand of basketball. Now, obviously, if you're one of the fans of the teams, like if you're the Memphis Grizzlies, who just defeated the Thunder as we are recording, then obviously it's not breaking your heart that Russell Westbrook's out. But in terms of, you know, the overall watchability, having guys like David Lee out, having guys like Russell Westbrook out, having half the Bulls roster out, having the Lakers' four top guards in their rotation out, having just, you know, a litany of injuries around the league, it's almost to the point where if you're one of the teams that actually has a healthy roster at this point, you've got a huge advantage over the field.
Yeah, agreed. And so what I'm getting out of this is I genuinely look at every single matchup in the second round, and I don't know. I mean, it's very easy to say that the Heat are going to turn it on and win four in a row, and the Spurs will turn it on and win the next three after being tested by the underdog. But I think that each series has 6-7 game potential. I really do. I think that, you know, the it could have been Phoenix Suns member Joakim Noah and the Bulls can really test the Miami Heat. The it could have been Phoenix Suns member Stephen Curry can really test the San Antonio Spurs. I think that those two series could be longer than what we originally thought, because, man, that Bulls team is scrappy, and Tom Thibodeau can coach. Another it could have been Suns coach, Tom Thibodeau. So all these it could have been players are leading teams against teams that they should be getting dominated by. But, yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it, and just based on first glance, two series tied at 1-1 with OKC and Memphis and with Indiana and New York. The other series are just one game played. They'll resume tomorrow. Right now I'm looking at it, and I am going to go like just my general predictions and who cares what they are, but I'm still going with OKC to the Western Finals. I'm going with them against San Antonio. I'm going with Indiana to knock off New York to face Miami, which was my preseason Eastern Conference Finals to begin with. My preseason Western Conference Finals was OKC and Denver, but Denver got bounced, so there's that. What are you seeing with the Final Eight, and how do you think it'll break down with the Final Four?
I think that the Thunder are in big trouble. At the beginning of the playoffs, that's who I actually picked to win the championship. I had them beating the Heat, but I think the loss of Westbrook is just too much for them to overcome. Durant has to shoulder way too much of the load without Westbrook out there to facilitate. And, you know, tonight, like I said, as we're recording, Durant has 36 points, 11 rebounds, 9 assists, and the Thunder still lose because he is basically Batman without his Robin out there. So I think the Grizzlies are going to take that series. And I kind of like the Grizzlies to make it to the NBA Finals now. I still think San Antonio beats Golden State, but I think that's going to be a really entertaining series. I think that the Warriors missed a huge opportunity in Game 1. And as Suns fans following the Phoenix Suns, we all know what happens when you squander an opportunity against the Spurs. They don't give you another one. So I think that San Antonio and Memphis are going to advance. The Knicks and Pacers, that one I could really see going either way. I'm kind of intrigued to see whether Amari can actually contribute anything to that series when he comes back in Game 3. But that one I think is completely up in the air. And, you know, logic, everything tells you that the Bulls can't beat the Heat with their depleted roster, everything that's gone on. But the other part of me thinks that, like, Tom Thibodeau might be able to coach me and you up, you and me, motivate us, and we might be able to beat the Heat. So I won't put it past them. I think that Thibodeau is a really great coach.
Yeah, I think so as well. And with that New York series, just a real quick tidbit, watching the game, George Hill, not Lance Stevenson. I was going to say Lance Stevenson did. I think it was George Hill. George Hill hits a jumper. They go up 64-62. Remember this vividly watching the game. timeout is called by the Pacers, ironically, by Frank Vogel to kill his own team's momentum. And after that, I believe it was a 30-2 run that the Knicks went on, just kind of out of nowhere. So it took a 30-2 outside of nowhere, out-of-body experience for the New York Knicks to be able to beat the Pacers today. And granted, yes, they won by a whopping 26 points. You're going to be like, oh, you're crazy that they barely beat them. But it took an out-of-body experience 30-2 run to beat the Pacers, and they did what they were supposed to do. You know, the Pacers went and won one game in New York like you're supposed to do. They're great at home. I think that they probably take care of business with the next two. I like the Pacers from the beginning, and I'll stick with them there. Going off of predictions, and I just want a real quick touch on this, and maybe we'll go into it in a little bit more detail next time because we ran long with the new GM stuff, rightfully so. But at the beginning of the season, I was laughed at, and rightfully so, for saying that the Suns were somewhere between a 39 and 41 win team. I thought that their ceiling was 500, and I thought 39 wins was their basement. If you had Goran Dragic doing what I thought he could do, which was 18-9, Luis Scola being the go-to scorer, Gortat playing well, et cetera. You know, Michael Beasley meeting expectations, so on and so forth. Perfect storm. The Suns can win 39 to 41 games. They clearly didn't meet that. They were 14 behind my basement for them, and they're drafting number 4 in the lottery that'll happen here in a couple of weeks. Where were you with your predictions in the preseason? I think I was one of the very, very, very few people that had them winning more than 35 games, let alone the 39 that I had them at. Where were you at in the preseason, and how did that meet your expectations?
I picked them in the upper 30s, too. I can't remember what exactly I picked. I know that I had set the range between 30 and 40, and I believe the way I phrased it was that I was going to be optimistic and pick towards the higher end of that range. But I do specifically remember, because I did a video preview through the SB Nation network of basketball teams, and I stated there that the two players on the Suns team, if you could tell me what kind of season they're going to have, how they're going to play, then I can tell you how the Suns are going to finish the season, what kind of season it's going to be, where their record will be. And the two players I named were Markieff Morris and Michael Beasley. And I said if those players can take steps forward and contribute to the team, that the Suns will be closer to that 40 and maybe even have a chance to sneak into the playoffs. And if those guys are the same Michael Beasley and Markieff Morris, then the team is going to be down at that 30-win range and possibly below. And though my win total may have been egregiously incorrect, and I was drinking the punch as I often do, I'm known as one of the most delusionally optimistic people on the bright side.
Clearly.
But that actually, I think, ended up being prophetical, because I think that if you want to name two players that really symbolize, that really kind of capture the Suns' pathetic franchise worst type of struggle, then Markieff Morris and Michael Beasley are the men for the job.
Yeah, I agree. I think in hindsight, if you would have said there was going to be a coaching season or a coaching change exactly midway through the season, and maybe a thing or two, like if you gave me three clues before the season and one of them was the coaching change, I probably wouldn't have gone as high as 39 wins. And I was wrong. I mean, a lot of people had them at the bottom of the West. I thought that was being overly skeptical. And a lot of people thought when I put them at 39 wins, I was being overly optimistic. And you're right. I drank the Kool-Aid. I went and, went to media day, watched a couple of practices, looked at the team and went, I like Alvin Gentry. I like Goran Dragic. I think that those guys can mix well. And, again, perfect storm. Those guys can win, 39, 40 games, somewhere in that range, and was well off of that. And I think that that's actually a good thing. I'm glad I was wrong, because if they would have finished with another 39 to 41 win year, another 500 mark goes on the franchise record, another year where they were at least above 500 and they were at least mediocre, then they would have had another mediocre at best pick in the NBA draft, and they would have been set up perfectly for another mediocre year next year. So I'm kind of glad that they went full-fledged into this, and they kind of fell on their face a little bit, because now they can begin to pick themselves up. And that's exactly what you need to do in the NBA. You need to be terrible to get better, or you need to get lucky in free agency and get some great players. But in most cases, you've got to, unless you're Boston or L.A., you got to get real bad real quick and build through the draft. Not a lot of teams can build through free agency. The Suns are not really one of those teams that builds through free agency traditionally.
I agree. I am glad I was wrong too, but I will not be deluded by optimism anymore, and I will make sure that I pick straight from the gut when the preseason predictions come around.
Yeah, this time next year, I want to play a Denny Green quote when we're talking about our predictions and if they met expectations. I want to just play Denny Green saying they are who we thought they were, and that's a team that's probably going to, again, win somewhere between 22 and 28 games, somewhere in that range. We'll see what happens in free agency. But, yeah, that's kind of recapping what we thought at the beginning of the season and looking ahead at good teams for a quick second there with the NBA Finals. So you got Memphis and were you saying Memphis-Miami? Is that what you're thinking?
I'm thinking that, yeah, it'll still be Memphis and Miami.
That'll be a good finals, though. Honestly, with all the four teams left in the West, as long as they're playing Miami, I think it'll be an entertaining finals. Chicago's that Cinderella team that knocks off a 4 seed, then knocks off a 10 seed, then beats the 2 seed, gets to the final four. And at that point, you're like, yeah, the Cinderella story was nice. Let's get the best teams in there. If Chicago's in the NBA Finals with, you know, half of their team in triage getting cared for and, you know, getting spinal taps, I don't know if that's the most entertaining finals in the world. You like to see Cinderella's story end eventually and watch the best talent in the world. But like you said, Tom Thibodeau can coach those guys. If they manage to knock off Chicago or Miami, who knows what their ceiling is.
And even though a lot of pundits, well, I don't necessarily know if it was pundits, a lot of talking heads were kind of suggesting that the Miami Heat might be able to navigate their way through the postseason without losing a single game. I even heard like references to the Lakers, Kobe Shaq team that went 15-1. But I think there's a lot of teams that can give Miami a very competitive series. And, you know, the team I predicted there, Memphis, if Memphis plays them, they've got a lot of size and defense. Perimeter defense with Tony Allen. They've got a lot of things that match up well against Miami. So if that ends up being the two teams that wind up playing there and I'm right, then that will, I think, be a very tightly contested series.
Completely agree. Yeah, and to those pundits' credit, without going too long into a diatribe about national stuff, to their credit, this is, in my opinion, the best NBA team since the 2000-2001 Los Angeles Lakers. You've had some great Spurs teams, some great Pistons teams, you know, the Miami team, the Boston team. I genuinely think that this is the best team in the past, you know, 12 to 14 years, this Miami Heat team. And, you know, if they end up winning a championship, we'll look back probably in 5 or 6 years and maybe mention them as one of the top 5 to 10 or, you know, 7 to 12 teams collectively as a team that ever played the game in that single season, and we'll do the hypotheticals of if they could beat the 98 Bulls and all that jazz that we like to do that is impossible to actually have happen. But there we go. That's episode 22. We will hopefully be back in effect next week with some great guests. The NBA Draft Combine starts next week on Thursday. NBA Draft Lottery in about 2 weeks now from today. And then we go forward with the NBA draft, which is about 45 days away. So a lot of interesting stuff, a lot of important stuff. Keep your eyes on Brightside, and we'll continue to have great content for you guys.
I'd like to reiterate that even though the Suns chose to go another direction with the GM hiring, that I'm still available to interview if they have any other lesser front office positions that they think a person of my unique skill set would be qualified for.
Jim C stands for Jim Consultant. He's there for you, Phoenix. Give him a call. He'll be the consultant that you, maybe not the consultant that you want, but the consultant that you need. We'll be back next week.